Welcome to the Design the Future podcast, where we talk with women leading the way towards a better built world. Design the Future is hosted by me, Lindsay Baker, with Kira Gould. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Design the Future podcast. It's good to be with you. This is Lindsay.
And this is Kira.
And yeah, here we are. It's been a while, Kira. I feel like we haven't gotten to do a podcast as much recently. So thank you for your patience. I'm sorry. Life.
Life intervenes. It's a thing. That's for sure. No, it's good. It's nice to be back in the conversation.
Yeah, exactly. I'm very happy to be here. It's still, I don't know how it still continues to feel like one of my favorite rituals that I have started in the past couple of years. This one, going to the gym, that might be it.
Well, that's great. I'm honored and I could not agree more. We recently passed our 2-year mark with this podcast. And so I've been thinking a lot about how grateful I am for it. Yeah. I do love it. It's really fun. It continues to make me think. And it sort of feels like an opportunity to reflect and consider things. And I love that.
Yeah. Someone sent me a note the other day saying that it's their background for doing craft projects. And I was like, yes, perfect.
Oh, I love that.
Imagining all of the women of like the sustainable built environment world out there on the weekends doing their crafting to each other, nerd out about the future of the movement is like, yes, I love everything about that.
That's great. I love that too. How fun.
Yeah, it is. But yeah, what else is going on with you? What's on your mind these days?
Oh, the usual. I have been thinking a lot about, it's mostly because I'm doing some talks and I've been thinking a lot about value and how we listen to other people. It's coming up a lot I've been trying to do talks about communications and leadership as they relate to sustainability. And so interesting to me how we don't really think of listening as a skill and we don't work on it, like how we do it. And that's not terribly helpful if we're trying to frame things in the value terms that make sense to other people.
Yeah, I love that. Well, and I know you have more recently been talking about these ideas around the words that we choose and how those words do or don't resonate with other people. And I love that point that you've been making about just how we oftentimes don't have the sort of rigor or the empathy or both to like think about our audience and the words that make sense to them or that describe what it is we're really getting at for them,
And I think it relates, it's specific to how we're, when we feel like we want to talk to different groups of people that maybe aren't exactly like us, it comes up a lot in the built environment community when we're trying to engage meaningfully with communities. And I think we have to work harder at finding ways to do that. That is not so extractive. And so like, tell us who you are, what you need this place to be, but that is more about absorbing through open questions, like what matters to them and why, and like, that's how we would get to that place of really understanding them.
Yeah. I feel like we had a podcast guest at some point who was making this distinction between starting with questions rather than starting with answers.
Well, it's a constant reminder for built environment professionals that are so used to dealing with like, I have the solution, that's what they want to come to the table with. And I get that. Like, they feel like that's their thought leadership position or something but you can't have the solution until you understand not just the place and the people, but also sort of like what is driving them and in what way. Like, we know that climate is touching everything right now, but we have to understand how for a specific place and specific people.
Exactly. Yeah, I love that point. Oh, I'm excited for you. Well, where are your talks going to be? People can go and see you talk, Kira.
Some of them. I think you're speaking in virtually at one of the same things I'm speaking this week.
Yeah. That's true.
Which is, so some of it's fun virtual stuff that's happening. And actually, that's an international conversation. Yes, which is so cool. I mean, that's the first for me. I have not done that kind of speaking before, so I'm very excited about that. And then just a variety of other things. I'm doing a women's leadership summit in September with AIA. That'll be interesting. And then a bunch of other AIA stuff at the AIA conference coming up.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Good stuff.
Look out for Kira at the AIA conference.
Yeah.
Wait, I guess maybe this won't publish until after. No, we will. Yeah.
Actually, we are hoping to, it will be out. That's funny. So normally we wouldn't be turning it around so quickly, but.
All right. Well, right. Find Kira. She'll be there.
I will.
All right. Cool. Well, I'm excited for your talks.
Thanks.
All of the connections, and I'm excited for our guest for today.
So am I. I'm super excited that we have Adele Houghton with us today. Welcome, Adele.
Thanks so much for inviting me. I'm so happy to be here.
We're delighted to have you, Adele. I'm going to do a quick introduction and then we'll jump into some questions. Adele Houghton is an architect. She works at the intersection of public health, climate change, and the built environment. Her research investigates the gap between the goals of local climate change and chronic disease policies on the one hand and the priorities of individual building project teams on the other. In 2005, she joined the Green Guide for Healthcare, the first best practices toolkit in the US to take a health-centric approach to green building design and operations. Adele is co-authoring a book, Architectural Epidemiology, which will come out next year, and she's going to tell us more about that. But first, I would really like to sort of start at the beginning a little bit. And Adele, will you tell us about how and why you got involved in architecture, green building, and then public health? What has been your path?
Great, thanks. Yeah, so I guess I got into architecture as an undergraduate. I went to a liberal arts school, so I didn't actually apply to the architecture program, but I took a class on architecture in my freshman fall, and I happened to take another class at the same time that was a history and theory class. And I really fell in love with this idea that the professor kind of used as the theme for the entire semester, which was, we're going to show you how to see the world in a different way, in a way that you've never seen it before. And when you leave this class, like, you're never going to walk down a street again and see it the same way you did before. And so I just started noticing things, I guess, around me, sort of like, you know, like, I wish I knew more about plants and bugs and, you know, birds and nature, and I just don't. So when I love to hike, but I feel like if I were there with a naturalist or a botanist, I would learn a lot more walking through the woods than I do. And this, in architecture, in that class, I started seeing buildings in the built environment in a way that's more nuanced, and I just noticed things in a way that I hadn't ever before. And that just really, I don't know, it struck a chord. And so I decided to major in architecture and went straight through to my master's degree. And when I was in graduate school and my master's in architecture, my dad had cancer, and I spent a lot of time in the hospital with him, and noticed I had already been kind of interested in this question of ecological design and green building, because it seemed to be, I was in school in the late 90s, and it was sort of just seemed like this is kind of the theme of our generation, that we were going to start moving away from thinking about urbanism and design just as a formal practice, but that we were really making a difference in terms of changing the natural environment through what we did as architects, and that we needed to be more responsible about that. And so I'm sitting around in this hospital with my dad and noticing, you know, that they would like come in every day and throw away 8 pillows. And it was just this very kind of, you know, on the one hand, very clean, but and sanitized, but on the other hand, just a very depressing and wasteful environment. And I happened to be interning that summer, one summer that I was spending a lot of time there with the Center for Maximum Potential Building Systems in Austin with Gail Vittori. And I was working with her on a project looking at how the built environment was destroying the water. It was polluting the water in Seattle and it was killing the salmon. And so, I don't know, I just kind of, all these dots started connecting in my head around chemicals and architecture and built environment and my dad being sick and everything. And so that sort of, I don't know, it just, I just realized that I wasn't gonna be able to go into this field if I didn't have a mission behind it. And I just happened to graduate from architecture school in 2003, which was right after USGBC was founded and LEED had just come out and they had just had the first green build in Austin and I lived in Houston and it just all kind of seemed to come together. And so I worked as a green building consultant at this architecture firm in Houston for a few years. And then again, I think that I just realized I have this very strong sense of mission and I didn't feel like I was able to meet that mission working in the commercial architecture environment. And so I ended up leaving my firm and switching over to a nonprofit that was called the Green Guide for Healthcare. And Gail became my boss again. And the Green Guide was basically a best practices toolkit that was authorized by the US Green Building Council to pilot what would become LEED for Healthcare. And the reason for this was because USGBC was exploding at the time. It was around 2005. And it seemed like every building class except for healthcare was on board with green building. It was just like, it was the new shiny object in the real estate sector. Everybody was doing it, but not healthcare. And so the question was why? Because healthcare was the second most energy intensive building type in the commercial kind of world, except for food service. And as people at the Green Guide like to say, all hospitals have food service inside of them. So they were just like, you know, energy intensive on top of energy intensive. And yet they weren't really interested. And the reason was because they didn't see how it was connected to their mission. And the argument that was being made around what's the value of green building was focused on energy and water reduction. And the operations of a hospital are like less than 1% of their operating budget. And so they just don't care. I mean, it's just not a financial driver for them. And so what the Green Guide did, which was quite brilliant, and before I came on board, was it basically was a collaboration between a group of people who were already involved in the healthcare sector and a group of people who are already involved in the green building sector. And they came together and they said, all right, if we can figure out what the evidence is in the literature to show that green building strategies can actually have a health benefit to the patients and the staff and the family members who are in these hospitals, as well as maybe the surrounding neighborhood, maybe the global community, then that would be a reason why healthcare might want to start getting on the bandwagon for green building. And they were right about that. And so I came in after the Green Guides had already launched and ran their pilot program. And we had about 150 pilots projects signed up, most of them in the US. And I guess to kind of continue my path forward, I was, you know, watching this transition that would happen within the projects that were in our pilot, where they would start out being skeptical. They'd say, well, we don't really see why this is important. Everybody talks about it as just saving energy and water. And, you know, we need to pay attention to the safety of our patients. And so if the question is reduce energy use or protect our patients, we're going for the patients every time, right? So then as they started using the Green Guide and started seeing that there were in fact health benefits related to it, both for their patients and their staff retention, particularly nursing retention, then all of a sudden there'd be this kind of like light bulb that would go off and say, wow, this is a really good idea. We should be doing more of this. And so then the ones that were more kind of further down the path started looking beyond their campus and started saying, okay, you know, we're seeing this rapid increase in patients who have chronic diseases. They're obese, they've got respiratory disease, et cetera. Why is it that we're seeing such a rapid increase over the past, say, 10, 20 years, to the point where we're actually having to redesign our hospitals and change our business practices away from acute care and towards managing chronic disease, right? Well, there's a built environment underlying determinant to that health. It's not just the built environment, but the built environment is a major contributing factor to that. And here we're seeing that what we're doing in our campus is actually benefiting the health of our patients and our staff. Well, why is it that these patients and staff are then going home to their communities and then being exposed to unhealthy environments that are making it hard for them to heal and potentially exacerbating their condition and sending them straight back to us? And so that's how I got into public health, was really kind of seeing that frustration amongst the pilots of the Green Guide and trying to understand where it came from and if other people were already researching this question. And of course I found, yes, they were, and they were in the public health sector. And so that's sort of how I made that transition over to public health.
Adele, I love that story. And I love the progression that you made over that time. And it's funny because it might be hard for some people listening to remember that we didn't used to, like, that when green building was becoming more mainstream, those connections to health were just not being made at the time. So what you guys did with the Green Guide for Healthcare was so important. And now it seems just odd to think that that was so poorly understood at that time. But those were such, that was such a big leap. Well, and you have really made your own career pathway. And I think it would be interesting, you know, if people are interested in bringing public health into their work in some way, what would you recommend either for people who are in school or studying or in practice already?
Yeah, that's such a great question. Thank you for asking me that. I have noticed, so I went back to school in 2010 to get a Master of Public Health, because when I left the Green Guide to basically try to replicate what that approach of taking a healthy approach to green building in the healthcare sector to the entire built environment, because it just seemed like we're not going to actually fix this problem unless we take a health-based approach on all projects. What I realized, I was lucky enough to be in a fellowship program with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention called the Environmental Public Health Leadership Institute. And that was where I kind of first learned some of the methods of public health. In architecture school, you don't learn social science methods, or at least I didn't. And I haven't seen that. So if there are architecture schools that are teaching social science methods, that's great, because I think we need to actually start learning them. I didn't have any of that background. And so what I ended up doing was just learning on the fly. As it turned out, this was, again, a hard, maybe sometimes hard to believe, but back in 2008, when I was doing that fellowship, it was right at the beginning of a lot of these municipal climate policies that started coming out in the more progressive cities. And at the time, I was living in Austin, which is a pretty progressive city, and they issued their first climate change policy, but it was specific to mitigation, in other words, reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Well, I was doing this public health fellowship, and so I thought, well, what if I worked with the city of Austin and their public health department to integrate issues related to public health into their climate policy? And what I discovered was, again, it's sort of, at the time I was like, why isn't everybody doing this? But there, it was very siloed, you know, so there were people that were doing mitigation on the one side, and then in public health, they were beginning to do a lot of research and trying out different policies, particularly at the local level around what we now call resilience. They called it adaptation, but they weren't touching the built environment. And so the innovation that I brought was to say, okay, well, what if we were to actually look at neighborhood level environmental determinants of health? In other words, if the issue in your city is extreme heat, like Austin, the other big issue there is flooding. How does the landscape either increase or reduce your risk by neighborhood by neighborhood? And then from bringing in the public health side of it, who's living in that neighborhood? Do you have a large concentration of, say, elderly in that neighborhood or young children who are more susceptible to both of those climatic hazards? Well, if you do, then if you combine those two pieces of information together, then you would say the policies for this city that are focusing on climate change really should be focusing on those neighborhoods, you know, so that another example might be renting. If you have a large group of rental properties and maybe they don't have as much tree cover and they don't have adequate air conditioning, then that's an area that the city should really be focusing, say, their weatherization programs and their air conditioning program, their cooling centers. And so what I started doing was bringing together design questions that came out of the green building sector with public health questions that came out of the types of research that were, you know, were being produced, but without thinking about the built environment as something that you could change. In public health, they think of the environment, the built environment and the natural environment, as immutable. Like, they don't try and change it. And so I think, to me, that's like this point of intersection that could really have a lot of potential if we were to bring these two pieces together. And so, you know, to go back to your question, I think what I realized is I was doing this completely on the fly. Essentially, I was asking people I was working with, I was getting grants and asking public health colleagues, you know, to help oversee what I was doing, to make sure that I was doing it correctly and doing the proper methods and all that sort of thing. But as an architect who had been licensed and had this sense of professional duty, as well as having run a green building best practice guide where we had to make sure that all of our recommendations were validated and were something that we could, you know, the project teams could say, well, if we do X, Y is going to happen and we can measure that. I just sort of felt like I needed to get some formal training. And that's why I went back to get the Master of Public Health. And I have noticed in the past 10 years since I graduated that a few others have followed that path as well, have kind of independently decided that they were really interested in health. They saw that public health follows a scientific method. And so they like the idea that you can create metrics and use methods that are validated and can be replicated. And so they were, you know, have also gotten mastered of public health. To date, as far as I know, there aren't any joint MARC MPH programs. There are MPH planning dual degrees, but I really think there's a difference between community planning and architecture. So, or you know, say civil engineering or mechanical engineering. I mean, I could imagine somebody getting an MEP MPH, right? Currently, that's not possible. So I would say that the two kind of ways to go about this at the current time are to do what I did, which you could say is sort of inefficient with your time. In other words, you get a master's in whatever your professional degree is going to be, and then you get a master's of public health or vice versa. The other thing is to learn on the job. And we're seeing people do it both ways. We're seeing people graduate from Master of Public Health degrees and then go work for architecture firms in their research department, you know, or in planning departments to try and bring a public health lens to community planning. And I know we're going to talk about my book. The point of the book really was to create essentially a curriculum that could be applied either inside the academia sort of environment or within a professional practice to teach people who have a professional background in design, engineering, real estate enough about the approach that public health takes to understanding the built environment and measuring impact, enough of a background in that to be able to essentially perform what I call a health situation analysis, understanding what your context is telling you should be the priority design strategies that you would want to incorporate into your project if what you care about is providing community benefit, environmental benefit, and health benefit.
I love all this, Adele. And yes, I do want to talk a little bit more about the book. So let's do that next, because I think what's so I'm super excited about your book. I think it also has potentially tremendous implications for being able to sort of quantify value of some of these strategies and the intersection that you describe. So I will not try to paraphrase it. I will let you further describe. You describe the why of the book. Maybe you could get into a little bit more of the what of architectural epidemiology.
Sure. So the book Architectural Epidemiology really comes from my Master of Public Health thesis, which was a research project where I took the climate maps that I had created with colleagues at the CDC and at through the City of Austin back in 2008 to 2012, where we really went neighborhood by neighborhood to understand what's a combination of environmental exposure to either extreme heat or flooding, and what does the population look like here? Do we have a demographic in that area that has maybe a lot of impervious surface that also is highly vulnerable to heat, for example? And so then that would become a hotspot, right? So we created these two maps. And then what I did in my thesis for the MPH was I then overlaid LEED certified buildings. And I did what's called a systematic literature review, which means that I looked at the scientific evidence at the time to understand what kinds of green building strategies, particularly I was looking at LEED, which LEED credits are shown by the evidence to be protective for either extreme heat or flooding. And are projects located in those neighborhoods that were identified by these vulnerability maps as being high risk, were those projects actually pursuing the strategies that would be most protective for that neighborhood? And the answer was the opposite. So the answer was no. And the projects that were using the strategies that were most protective were actually in the least risk neighborhoods. And I thought, this is crazy, right? I mean, that's not what we're attempting to do as green building practitioners, right? Why is it that these projects in a very progressive city that knows it's got a heat and a flooding problem, why is it that they're not pursuing what seems to me to be quite obvious, you know, prioritization? And I think the reason is that they didn't actually know that they were in a high-risk neighborhood, even though these maps had already been created and they were available. So what the book does is it basically walks through step by step. This is how you perform, again, what I call a health situation analysis. So how do you make use of all this open data that's available at the neighborhood level? And for those of you who do geographic spatial analysis, I'm talking about the census tract level. And there's just a lot of it available. So you can combine these open data sets around environmental exposure with open data sets around population health needs and use that combination of information to help you prioritize and say, in this census tract, in this neighborhood, we really should be looking at mental health and air pollution. In the one next door, we should be really focusing our efforts on flooding and cancer risk, just as an example. And so the idea is that when you use the book, by the end of chapter two, you will be able to identify for your project pretty quickly, these are the top, say, three health issues that really would make a really big difference for the neighborhood if we were to pursue them for this project. And then we've got this whole appendix that goes through 10 different health topics. Five of them are climate related and five are chronic disease and mental health related. And we go through the evidence in the literature and say, these are the strategies that make the most sense and could be the most protective for each of those health issues. And so by combining those two pieces of information, you both know what you should prioritize, and you also know this is a group of credits or a group of design strategies and operation strategies that would have the most benefit for this neighborhood. And then for the value proposition side of it, then what's great about this is because those metrics are based on existing rating systems like LEED, like WELL, like FitWell, like Living Building, they're actually things that project teams are already tracking, right? And so they can actually say, well, you know, to the neighborhood and to the community, we're pursuing these strategies that are evidence-based because we identified this neighborhood is really needing some help in this area. And so we're making a tangible improvement to the neighborhood on something that matters to that neighborhood. And then from the community's perspective, many of the climate action plans, the community health needs assessments and improvement plans, air pollution reduction plans, many of those community plans also use similar metrics. And so it's actually easy to identify how a single parcel is contributing to a strategy that's been set for the community. And to me, that's a sort of last mile gap that's been missing, where you've got people looking right now internally to their project, but they're not considering how what they're doing is actually going to impact the neighborhood. Or if they are, maybe they haven't been able to capitalize on that, use that information in a way that could help them, say, get the community on board with what they're doing so that they are able to breeze through the public approvals process or even find ways to supplement their financing.
I love all of this. I'm so excited about the book, Adele. And I just, I don't know. There's a lot about it that speaks to me anyway of some cultural shifts, you know? Yeah. Anyway, maybe we can talk about that in a minute, because before we get into that, I also want to ask you about another exciting part of your work, which is the AIA Upjohn Research Grant. So can you tell us about that project and its purpose and how it fits into your work overall?
Sure. Yeah. That is, it's such an amazing opportunity, really, because I just have been, as you know, as I still identify as an architect, whenever people ask me to introduce myself, even in public health settings, the first thing I say is I'm an architect and a green building consultant. And so to be able to do some of the work that I've been pursuing sort of on the side, a little bit in the shadows over the past few years, but to be able to kind of bring that back into the fold and do it as part of an Upjohn Research Initiative project really means a lot to me personally. But basically the idea behind that grant is to test out the value proposition I was just laying out. So I'm working with about half a dozen real estate projects around the country. They're sort of dispersed across the country. And they're all different asset types. You know, there's like an industrial site, there's, you know, a municipal site, there's some mixed use, there's some affordable housing. We're trying all the different flavors and different locations, some in the South, some in the North, some in the Midwest. And the idea is that my hypothesis is that if we were to present project teams with data that is specific to their site, that helps them prioritize what health issues they should be focusing on if that's their goal, is to provide community benefit, then if we provide that data to them and that ranking, that it would, and also the evidence-based strategies associated with that, that it would potentially create an opportunity for alignment between the development team, the community surrounding the project that will be impacted by the project, and the local government. So that what many times can be a contentious process in terms of getting a project through the public approvals process might actually turn into something that's a lot more productive for everybody. And so everybody leaves that conversation getting more of what they want, right? The community is able to point to data saying, this is why we keep telling the developer that we want, say, a soccer field here, or that we feel like it's important to have a grocery store. The community, the local government can say, you know what, we never get any data from private landowners. And so we've been forced to do all of our calculations around climate action based on the public realm. Well, wouldn't it be great if we integrated into our permitting process, this kind of metric, which is a process metric, it's something that the developers and their consultants are already tracking anyway, and it could be used to demonstrate that the city is actually closer to achieving its goal for the Paris Climate Agreement than they thought they were, right? Everybody gets more out of the process. We'll see. It's a proof of concept. So that's the goal. So next summer or next spring, I'll be issuing a report through the AIA website with a summary framework that will hopefully say that this approach worked and that this is how we did it. And these are suggestions for how you could replicate this approach in any local jurisdiction, with the idea that eventually it might actually lead to more neighborhood specific zoning requirements, permitting requirements, et cetera.
Mm, that's super cool. I'm excited for that. I hope it works.
I know, I keep telling people, you know, it's a proof of concept. So it could totally, like, you know, I could fall on my face here, but you know, that's what research is about, right? Yeah. You want to experiment. It's an experiment.
Yeah. And I think that's the important thing to take away from this for those of us listening that are, you know, coming more from the architecture background. It's like you are exemplifying like what it means to bring in that spirit of research and of, you know, actually testing your hypotheses to a practice that doesn't tend to have that attitude. So that's a good transition to asking you a little bit more about how you see yourself now. You talked a little bit about this, but when you think about the work that you're doing, do you these days consider yourself to be a part of an industry? Do you consider yourself to be a part of a movement? Like, how do you situate yourself in sort of that? I don't know, it's kind of related to this point you were making about being an architect and then getting your public health background, there, you know, public health credentials. Like, how do you think about, relationship do you have to the profession these days?
Yeah, you know, I've thought about that a lot because my website for my company has always had climate change, green building, and public health on it. And the way that these, and to y'all's conversation earlier at the beginning of this podcast, this question about language, it comes up, right? Because public health, and as I know many people know because of COVID, public health in the US tends to sort of live in government, mostly at the local level, local health departments, and in academia. So they don't really want to be called an industry, right? They call themselves a field. I also work on climate change, right? And climate change is this sort of like amorphous thing. I'm not sure if I would call it a movement, but it's definitely, it has a lot of tentacles that go into a lot of different industries. And then of course, green building, we do think of that as an industry. So I don't know. I do identify as a professional. I'm an architect, so I'm a professional, and I have to be guided by my ethics, and the, you know, health, safety, and welfare, commitment that I made when I got my license. So I think that guides a lot of what I do. And I do think, that those of us who have gone into green building from one of the professions around real estate, definitely all of us have some kind of mission. And so in that sense, we're all part of a movement. We're not just building buildings to get a paycheck or because they're pretty or, you know, whatever. Like, we're doing it because we want to make the world a better place. And so I think in that sense, there's that sense of kind of optimism and aspiration that never really goes away. It's sort of the thing that draws people like me into the green building industry to start out with. I think there's also a lot of disillusionment in the industry right now. And that's, I've was telling Kira yesterday that I actually did, as part of sort of the preamble to the Upjohn Research Grant, I interviewed about two dozen, actually it's now getting closer to 50 people across the spectrum of real estate over the past 2 or 3 years to ask them, like, if you're doing healthy building, why are you doing it? What are the barriers? You know, what do you see as being the factors within the real estate industry that are supportive of that approach? And I over and over again, I heard this frustration about we're not making the impact that we thought we were going to make when we got into this, right? And I've been doing this for 20 years now, right? And I think I started feeling that frustration very early on when I was first at my architecture firm right out of school. And that's sort of what propelled me in this kind of very strange circuitous pathway that I've taken to say, all right, I see I'm not making the impact I want. I see we have technologies. I see we have strategies that we could be using to make an impact. Why is the impact not happening? And I really have come to believe firmly that the problem is that we're not targeting, we're not prioritizing based on what the site and its surroundings are telling us need to be prioritized. And so that sort of sent me down this 10-year process of writing this book that hopefully will come out next year. And we'll see. I mean, I'm hopeful that it will help at least move the needle a little bit so that people who've been looking around for this kind of information and see that what they're doing isn't having the impact on the neighborhood around them the way they want it to, that they could begin to start measuring their impact and really responding to what is needed in a neighborhood so that what they're doing is kind of creating a positive ripple effect throughout the community.
That's super cool. Okay, well, there's a lot more we could talk about there, but we are nearing the end of our time and there's a couple more questions that we want to ask. And one of them kind of just speaks to your sense of momentum. Like I hear a lot of like, you know, you've got a lot on that you're working on and a lot of progress that you're making. And so I just, it's almost a question about, you know, if you look back 10 years ago and thought about what you were hoping we would have accomplished by now, how are we doing? And like, how do you personally grapple with that sense of like, of progress, you know, milestones and things? Like for some of us, we thought about the year 2020 as a particular milestone. I'm curious if you did that for yourself and your work and sort of, you know, how are we doing? How's the transformation going?
You know, that's so funny. I think that 2020 to me is like the lost year, right? It's like the COVID year. It's like the year that like didn't exist. It's one of the 2 years that somehow like happened, but we don't remember what happened during them. So true. But yeah, so if I think back 10 years ago from now, I guess when I think back, it's probably more 15 years ago when I was working at the Green Guide for Healthcare, and there was just this incredible momentum. I mean, it just felt like, you know, if you think about the Omicron, you know, curve that was just like exponential, it was almost like I was joke with my husband that it was almost like so far north, like straight up, that it was going backwards. It felt like that with during the Green Guide. It just felt like we had this incredible momentum and everybody was on board all of a sudden. And we started having CEOs of like health systems use the Green Guide slides and like not even cite us. And my boss, Gail, he would be like, that's when you know you've succeeded, you know, that's how we know that we've like really made a culture change in the health system world, you know, that they had just bought into what we were trying to convince them of, that they had taken it on as their own. And I will say that when I started, so I'm getting a doctorate in public health right now at Harvard. And when I first went, so the first year was part of the lost years. I did it online. But then when I went on campus last August, there are signs all over the School of Public Health about green is the new crimson and, you know, recycle here. And this is what we're doing to save energy and, you know, just sort of raising awareness throughout the School of Public Health about how Harvard is embracing sustainability, and not Harvard as a university, but particularly the School of Public Health. And that to me was a win. That was like, okay, you know, there definitely is a sense, I think, throughout the green building industry that we've kind of gotten to like the levels of like, you know, a Fortune 100 company where you just don't see that rapid explosive growth that you see with like startups. But if it's totally infiltrated into the institution, that's a plus. And so I guess I would say, you know, on the one hand, there's a part of me that wants every hospital to be net zero and Living Building Challenge certified and, you know, producing agriculture on their roof and everything else. But I, you know, I do think that there has been a culture shift in the sense that it's not something that is seen as outside of the norm anymore. So in that sense, I'd say it's good. The other thing that I've seen that has been new that is really intriguing to me is just in the past year at Glasgow, the COP26 for the climate negotiations, that buildings were finally identified as central to actually making a difference around climate change. I have been so frustrated that they haven't been. And we finally have begun to see a little bit of cross-pollination between the people who go there and have a whole day about climate change and health, and then the other people that go the next day or the day before and have a whole day about buildings and climate change. And it's like, dude, these things should be combined. It doesn't make sense in my brain for them to be separated. So I think we're beginning to see a little bit of cross-pollination there. Again, taking from the Green Guide model, it's great that healthcare has been the lead in being the one that has been sort of integrating the two, but we need to move beyond healthcare. Healthcare is a very important sector, but it's not the only sector in real estate. And we need to find a way for all of real estate to embrace this approach. The last thing I'll say is this question about ESG and real estate, that in my mind, that is a really, really important topic that is still emerging. And if we could find a way for, as those metrics are being kind of turned into a system that is agreed upon by all, if the S piece of that becomes health situation analysis. In other words, understanding your context and how your context is the way that you define what the value is around ESG, whether it's in terms of environment, whether it's in terms of equity, whether it's in terms of population health outcomes, we could really see a huge spike in investment around green and healthy buildings that could make a huge difference in meeting the Paris Climate Agreement and also in addressing some of this culture change that I feel like a lot of us in the industry have been kind of trying to figure out how do we get there.
No, for sure. I love that point. I wish we could talk more about it. We have to wrap up. And my last question that we always love to ask people is about who is inspiring you these days. So I wonder if you could help close us out with that and just give us some ideas. I don't know, maybe it's somewhere in the realm of public health, but like who do you look to for momentum?
You know, the person that I've been thinking about recently is Jacinda Ardern, who is not in public health.
Yes.
She is the Prime Minister of New Zealand. And I just think she's amazing. She is young. She is both visionary and practical. She sees the world in a pragmatic way and is willing to talk about issues without, you know, without going around it. And yet she does it in a way that is constructive and not polarizing and is able to create consensus. And I recognize, you know, she comes from a small country and so there's probably something related to that. But I do think that there are lessons for us, those of us who aspire to be leaders and are trying to make big change, thinking about somebody like her. I was just looking at Wikipedia. Apparently she wrote a book called I know this to be true, on kindness, empathy, and strength. And I thought, you know, that's right. I would say also you need to be visionary in a sense. Like you need to know where you're going. But in order to get people to come along with you, you need to both know where you're going, but you also need to be empathetic and understand why different stakeholders have the position that they have, that there's a reason for it. And there's, it's not helpful to polarize. It's important to understand. And I mean, to Kira's point earlier about asking open questions, understanding, trying to build a sense of common understanding and alignment. That's sort of what I'm trying to do with the Upjohn Research Initiative grant, is see if I can find a way to do that with groups that traditionally many times, and for a reason, are, they have different priorities, right? But there's a common set of priorities as well. And so if, I think she's just done such a great job of not giving up on the aspiration while she's pragmatic about trying to get where she wants to go.
That is a wonderful one. I love it. Also, because coincidentally, I think she might have been in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago, and I like may have been in the same building as her, and I was just enjoying the vibes of like,
how cool.
In the house. Yeah. Anyway, that is a wonderful one. Thank you so much, Adele, for sharing that with us. And thank you for being here. It's been such a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, thank you. I've really enjoyed talking with you guys.
Of course, it's been so fun. So yeah, that is it for us this week on the Design the Future podcast. Thanks again, everyone, for listening. Please leave us a review on Apple. It really matters. It helps people find us. Stay safe, and we'll see you next time.